Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in this enterprise, Elliot Cohen, the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic International Studies, Professor Emeritus at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Elliot, how are you?
I'm good. I am particularly looking forward to today's session because as somebody Boston born and bred, I really like salty New Englanders, and I think they don't get enough credit.
Well, we'll get to that in good time. We promised our listeners last time because we were recording just on the eve of the presidential debate that we would give some at least, brief takeaways from the debate. My own sense of it, and I'm curious about yours, was I don't think it was quite the wipeout that some people, have portrayed it as, although clearly Kamala Harris, I think, established herself as, a plausible commander-in-chief, a plausible president of the United States. I thought after some initial nervousness, she handled herself extremely well through most of the night and managed to get under Trump's skin very effectively and, causing him to really rant, rave, melt down, et cetera. I did think, the fact-checking was necessary on Trump. I think it would have helped, frankly, if ABC had fact-checked her a little bit. I thought she gave a particularly bad answer, for instance, on Afghanistan, where she actually misstated the presence of U.S. troops in combat zones. And I think she could have done with a little fact-checking, too, just to make it look a little bit, more even though, it's totally asymmetric. But, I came away kind of shaking my head because the thing that is most disturbing, and maybe it'll change with polling, but the notion that people could look at that and see Trump and say, yeah, I want 4 years of that in my, my living room for the next 4 years, just is, makes me crazy. And, the fact that the election is so close, just find incredibly disturbing.
Yeah, I agree with all those things. They're appealing to a very narrow slice of the electorate. And from that point of view, it was a big win for Harris, because if you were kind of wondering whether Trump is as crazy as you sort of remembered him being, he confirmed that he's as crazy as you remembered him being. And if you had doubts whether she, as you said, basically could handle the presidency, even if you don't think she's hugely impressive, she certainly cleared that bar, and it was at some level entertaining because she had clearly thought about how to get him under his skin, and boy did he respond, including with the Haitians eating the cats and dogs. So I don't know that it moves huge numbers. I think the criticism that, she hasn't offered really concrete proposals and kind of didn't go into all the details of her economic policy, that's not what she needs to do to win the election. What she needs to do to win the election is make it clear that this guy is wildly unfit, that she's perfectly sane and willing to move her positions around, which I think she is, in part because I'm not sure her principles are all that deeply held anyway.
Which may be a virtue in this instance, but.
Oh, I think it's absolutely a virtue. At this juncture, I'm not sure I want excessively highly principled people. And the optics were of a new generation, thank goodness, sort of a post-baby boomer generation. I always get mixed up between Gen X, Gen Z, millennials, whatever, but it's after you and me. I thought that was good. Now, whether people watching that will be the people who will change their votes, who will shape their votes. I don't know. I think it may motivate more people to show up and pull a lever, who were sympathetic to Harris but had their doubts. So I don't know. I do find it interesting that Trump does not want to debate her again. I think this must have been for him to be beaten by a woman of color, no less, has to have been very disconcerting for him.
I think that's right. I wouldn't rule out that, you know, if the polls start to lengthen and his team concludes that, you know, the only option they have is a Hail Mary. I mean, he's so, inconsistent that I wouldn't rule out, you know, another debate. But
so here's the secret advice, which I will just share with listeners to shield on the Republic and with the Harris campaign. If there is another debate, just say how much you like Taylor Swift.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, one of the things that the debate did highlight, as I was saying, that is the continued polarization of the electorate, the kind of catastrophic kind of political rhetoric that people, you know, are engaging in, you know, the end of democracy, the end of our country, according to Trump, if Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are elected. And because here on Shield of the Republic, we believe if you want to understand the, you know, the present of American history and American national security and politics, you need to understand the past. We have the perfect guest to help us untangle all that. We have Lindsay Chervinsky with us, who is the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon, a wonderful place, by the way. If you haven't been, please take your kids. And the author of this book, Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. Lindsay, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So let me start out kind of at the end of your book, if you would let me. At the end of the book, you talk about the very important role that John Adams played in the incredibly disputed election of 1800, in which, to just set the scene for listeners who may not have had the benefit yet of reading your book, although I hope they all go out and buy it and read it because it's such a terrific book. The Constitution had left some gaps in understanding presidential succession and how the president would be confirmed after election by the Congress. Because as you described, we had this very patchwork system where some states chose electors by popular vote. Some states had a legislative election and the legislatures chose the electors. It went on, not on one day, but over a period of months. There had been a succession from Washington to his vice president, John Adams, in 1796, but that was between, you know, a president and vice president of the same party. And so there was no real contestation. In 1800, it was highly contested between Adams and his vice president, Thomas Jefferson, former friends who'd been involved in the Revolution together, but had seen politics differently over the years, saw things very differently while Adams was president and Jefferson was vice president. Pretty brutal campaign. And against a backdrop of intense factionalism in the Federalist Party, Adams doesn't really even really control his party. And he, when the election comes and he loses, he does not take part in any of those intrigues that were going on to try and keep Jefferson from becoming president because of the quirks of the rules, he and Burr have the same number of votes and ultimately has to go to the House of Representatives. Adams stays out of it and works to make a smooth transition to Jefferson. And you, at the end of the book, talk about January 6th having unsettled you because of the fact that you took, like all of us, the peaceful transfer of power for granted. And I want you to tell us about what role did that play in having you write this book? Because a lot of other books have been written on Adams recently. There's the David McCullough book, and there's a John Furling biography, and there's many books about the contested election of 1800.
initially always planned to write an Adams book, and it was largely motivated by the question of how does the presidency work once Washington leaves it? Because he established so many critical precedents, but he was such an unusual character in American history because he had this unprecedented and I think never to be repeated stature and the respect of the American people in such a way that he was really unquestioned in a lot of the things that he did. And so the powers that he used, the decisions that he made, were sort of a theoretical precedent until they were tested or used by someone else. So I kind of had that vision in my head. And then January 6th happened. And as you said, I realized that I had really been taking it for granted, despite being a student of American institutions. And I should say, a very patriotic one. I believe very strongly in our American institutions. And yet I took them for granted. And I realized once I watched that and I started looking back to see, okay, how did these first transitions actually happen? What were the small nuanced decisions that we know add up to a peaceful transfer of power? How did they happen? That most people hadn't written about them. And I think it's because they hadn't lived through that. So even the best John Adams biographies tend to give relatively few pages to the Adams presidency. And I think that's because they were not asking questions like, how did John Adams create the peaceful transfer of power? Because they just hadn't experienced that. And we know that history depends on the questions that you ask. And without asking those questions, it's easy to sort of gloss over this presidency. And so asking those questions really unlocked his administration for me in a way that allowed me to see the small things that often require restraint or behind the scenes decency and virtue. Those are not the things that typically make it onto monuments around the Tidal Basin in Washington, D.C., but I think that they're critically important.
So I very much share Eric's feeling about the book. It is a wonderful book. And we really commend it to all of our listeners. There are so many interesting angles to it. And one of them you've alluded to, that you do not regard Adams' presidency as, if not a failure, not a particularly great time, which I think is usually is too often the take. I mean, it's quite apart from the transition power. He manages a very severe diplomatic military crisis with France very well. And of course, most people haven't even heard of the quasi-war, but it is very much worth paying attention to. I mean, there's so many things I'd like to talk to you about, and I will want to explore that one at length. But first, actually, I'd like you to speak to something that really struck me, which is the book casts a pretty unfavorable light on Hamilton. This will annoy my grandchildren, who in turn annoy me by singing songs from that musical. So they have it coming to them. But also Washington, who, does not bring Adams into cabinet meetings, really does not prepare him for the presidency. I found that part, the Hamilton story, I sort of know. This is an intensely ambitious guy who sees himself as a general. That's the one part of his ambition I think that's really thwarted, although he comes through in the end in the election of 1800.
He was a colonel.
Yeah, well, we've known people like that. he does come through and kind of helps Deep Six Aaron Burr, because at least he thinks that Jefferson is sane, even though he disagrees with him. I know. Again, there are other elections that have some parallels with that. And of course, Jefferson, who is really quite unscrupulous. He was quite unscrupulous in how he dealt with Washington. He was quite unscrupulous in the way he dealt with Adams until the moment of that transition. So I wonder if I could draw you out on that. And then I'm going to want to turn back to the French Revolution maybe later in the conversation. Maybe if you could begin with Washington, because I came away from this, I think, in way more baffled by Washington than I had been. The way he treats Adams, the way in which he undermines the civilian control of the military that he so valued and for which he set such important precedents. Maybe if you could explain the story to our listeners, but then comment on it.
Absolutely. Let me actually start. I just want to circle back to what you said at the beginning, which is that I have made it my mission to encourage Americans not to assess whether or not a presidency is a success by whether or not they were reelected. I think it's a real mistake to think that a president is successful if and only if they win a second term. And the example I usually give for that is George H.W. Bush in our modern period. I don't think that he should be deemed a failure for the lack of a second term, because as we know, re-election often hinges on things like gas prices, and presidents often have very little to do with that. In terms of the three greats that you mentioned, or what we think of as the three greats, the Washington, Hamilton, and Jefferson, the Washington piece for me was also the most baffling, because Hamilton is best understood as he's just always a little bit nuts. And when Washington was president, Hamilton kind of had a safe space through which to channel his energies. And he was never going to be too extreme as long as Washington was in charge, because he had such respect and deference for Washington. And Jefferson, we can circle back to Jefferson, but I think Jefferson deserves to be considered among the worst vice presidents in American history, because he comes remarkably close to treason during that time. But Washington, I agree with you, is often the most complex. And so just a little bit of the backstory. In the summer of 1798, it appeared likely that war with France might be on the horizon. And this is known as the Quasi-War, when French ships are seizing American ships and imprisoning American sailors and stealing their goods. But war has not been declared, and Adams has not declared war, and Congress is kind of trying to figure out what to do with it. In addition to finally creating a real navy and a naval department for the first time, which Adams was ecstatic about as a good, proper New Englander, Congress also expanded the American army to 50,000. And Adams, knowing that a lot of the members of his cabinet and a lot of members of the extreme wing of the Federalist Party, which I call the Arch Federalists, wanted to put Hamilton, a lowly colonel, in charge of this huge new army, decided that the best way to thwart Hamilton's ambitions was to ask Washington to come back as commander-in-chief of these forces. Some people say that this decision is kind of crazy. I don't blame him for this decision, because A, no one could argue with Washington coming back. No one could say Hamilton deserved it more than Washington. But Adams was in a uniquely difficult position, because as long as Washington was alive, there were effectively two presidents in the American imagination, and there were effectively two commander-in-chiefs. And that has not been true for any other former president. Now we have a very clear understanding of who is in charge and who is not. And Washington was such a huge force, such a huge shadow looming over the Adams presidency, that I think he had to bring him in. Through a series of machinations, members of the cabinet and their allies in the Arch Federalists kind of convinced Washington, and I don't totally place all of the blame on Washington for this, into boxing Adams into a corner. And basically, Washington threatened to resign if Adams did not allow him to appoint his own generals and subordinate officers in whatever order he wished. Adams had to back down, otherwise his presidency would have been completely kneecapped. He would have had no chance of really surviving those 4 years, politically speaking, and he had to give in. And Alexander Hamilton was made the number two, which was important because Washington planned to remain at Mount Vernon until the French army actually invaded the United States. So Hamilton, for all intents and purposes, had all of the governing power. This was extremely problematic because Hamilton wanted to use the army for his own purposes. He had ideas of marching through the South to go to South America, seizing the Floridas and New Orleans along the way, maybe crushing some domestic enemies in the South while he was conducting this march. They wanted to use the new army as basically a spoils system for the Federalist Army. So this was an incredibly partisan force. So when we later talk about Adams undermining the army, that's actually a really good thing. That's not something we usually want the president to do, but in this particular moment was quite essential. And he had the support of a lot of the cabinet members. So Adams was in an incredibly difficult spot. And I think this is one of those moments where I share the same confusion, because Washington had spent his entire public service career effectively building up civilian control over the military, being incredibly deferential to Congress when he was commander in chief of the Continental Army, asserting civilian control as president over the military. And he would have never permitted another officer to demand that he have this right while he was president. But what I think makes this moment perhaps useful to us is that civilian military relations are really hard, and they've always been really hard. And in a republic, they're always going to be challenging. And the way I see it is, if someone who had up until this point such a sterling track record as Washington struggled with it, then it's not really a surprise that sometimes we struggle with it today too.
I think might be useful for our listeners. You touched on something very important. I'm interested in your and Eliot's view of this. So you mentioned that Adams is quite enthusiastic about setting up the Navy, because he sees the Navy as really the handmaiden to diplomacy, that being able to threaten the French on the high seas, where there are depredations of U.S. commerce are going on, is going to help him as a diplomat. He was a former diplomat, had negotiated with the French before. Not so enthusiastic about the army. And he's not so enthusiastic about the army, both on principle and for political reasons. So on principle, like all of the founders, he had a deep-seated fear of standing armies. This is rooted in a lot of their reading of the classical literature about, you know, ancient Rome, but also Molesworth's History of Denmark, in which standing army overthrows republics. Moreover, the army required a high level of taxation to support it, and those taxes were extremely important, unpopular with the electorate. So from Adams' point of view, doesn't it totally make sense to do what you say? Didn't it sort of, you know, pump up the Navy, but, you know, try and, despite the fact that he had what you described as this, you know, sort of shadow hanging over him, slowly kind of undermining the notion that we actually needed a large standing army, which is actually causing a problem. And this is really kind of a function of the extremism of what you call the arch, or what some people call the high federalists. Is that all fair?
Absolutely. Not only was the Navy really important for diplomacy, I think, if I'm not going to butcher this, I think Reagan said peace through strength. Is that his phrase? So Basically Adams' version of that was diplomacy with a really strong Navy. Navy was his stick and diplomacy was his carrot. And furthermore, the Navy also paid for itself. So in 1 year, through insurance savings, through merchant shipping, the Navy basically retailers saved enough money to pay for what it cost to create the Navy. So the Navy had a real economic plus in addition to the defensive and diplomatic purposes. As you said, the army was incredibly expensive. As 1798 ticked into 1799, and it seemed less and less likely that there was actually going to be an invasion, you had this massive force with nothing to do. And anyone who has ever spent time with a lot of armed young men with nothing to do knows that that's generally not a great equation for domestic tranquility. As you said, the taxes were extremely unpopular because this was the first direct tax on American citizens by the new federal government, meaning a tax collector actually had to go from home to home and assess property. And you can imagine roughly how well that went, given that a lot of the people who were having to pay this tax had lived through the Revolution, when they had expressed their ideas very clearly about taxation. And many of the people who had expressed their concerns about a standing army during the Revolution were still alive and still had concerns about the standing army. And Adams knew all of this. Not only did he witness it and experience it with his own eyes and his own ears, Abigail Adams, his wife, wrote to him from Quincy, Massachusetts, when their house was assessed. And she said, "This is a terrible system. This is complicated and convoluted, and people are going to hate it." And then on his way back and forth between Philadelphia and Quincy, he saw the Liberty Poles, which were protesting this tax and its unpopularity. And so he knew exactly how Americans felt about it. And he warned the Arch Federalists, "You are not going to like what's going to happen if we continue to do this. But if you want an army, I will give it to you." I think perhaps for me, more interestingly, he also told James McHenry, the secretary of the War Department, "Do not make me choose, because I'm very clear on my favorite," which I think is maybe not something you want a president to say to a department, but in this case, I can understand it.
Isn't there also another element, which is for Adams, like for many presidents thereafter, the Navy is sort of a symbol of national honor. You know, It's the Navy that carries the flag over the seas. It's the Navy that prevents foreigners from directly interfering with Americans. You know, I think Teddy Roosevelt, even though he had served in the United States Army, would have said exactly the same thing. I mean, this there is something that's very powerful. And of course, navies, by and large, don't launch coup d'etat for obvious
reasons.
Except in Argentina.
Well, Argentina depends. We can talk about Admiral Horthy in Hungary, but I think that would be another rabbit hole for us to go down. I just to close the loop on Washington, I have to say one of the things that I found myself thinking, as enormous an admirer of Washington as one has to be and one should be, his judgment of people was not often somewhat off. So, I mean, because I'm talking about another rabbit hole, I'm on the board of trustees of Fort Ticonderoga up in
Nevada. Here we go.
I'm not going to talk about that.
I'm sensing this is not the first time this has come up.
And what a great guy he was, but he was. But, you know, the guy who blows the siege of Fort Ticonderoga is Arthur Sinclair, mm-hmm. who Washington later on appoints to be head of the army and then leads the army into the greatest defeat that it ever suffers at the hands of Native Americans. The guy was a doofus. And mm-hmm. And yet Washington kind of favored him. And I think it's, you know, it's fair to ask whether Washington was, in some ways, I'm sure he was an excellent judge of character. When it came to Hamilton or to Adams, who was a prickly fella and was not, did not simply accept subordination to Washington during the Revolution, I wonder if that might have played a role of some kind too. Could I ask you to talk about the French Revolution? I mean, I've got a feeling your book will bring back to some of our listeners kind of hazy memories of American history, you know, in the first year of high school, the XYZ affair. What was that again? Yeah. But it is a fascinating story. And it's a fascinating story of how the revolutionary politics of the greatest country in Europe begins reverberating in the United States, and politicians are willing to take advantage of it. To align with it against their own country's interests. Could you just talk a little bit about that and how Adams plays through that?
Yeah, so I do really think that the French Revolution is the backdrop through which most of these conversations and interactions and fears are percolating. And I think the French Revolution should really be understood in two distinct ways for its impact on this period. First, of course, was the radicalism and the violence. So Americans at this time were the opposite of isolationists. They were incredibly aware of what was happening in the world. They were very well read about foreign affairs, largely because foreign policy dominated the federal government was focused on, but also their lives, and had such huge impact on trade and their economy and sort of every sort of tangible public piece of life. So they were very aware of the French Revolution and the violence of especially the Reign of Terror, the fact that it was characterized by guillotines and blood literally running through the streets, was the picture that they were envisioning as a worst case scenario for what could happen in politics. And they had not forgotten that. And so when they were thinking about transitions, even 1797, when it was in the same party and there was no expectation of it being violence, that was what they were thinking of. And that image was very powerful. The second piece was after the Reign of Terror ended and the outward violence had ended, France continued to have a series of basically constitutional coups, of turnovers in which one directory would throw out the other, they would have another convention, they would do something extra constitutional, there would be a new directory. And these happened again and again and again, and they culminated in Napoleon coming to power as emperor eventually of France. And so Americans were both worried about the radicalism being imported, whether it was through French immigrants or Haitian immigrants, and that the Jeffersonian Republicans would side with those immigrants to sort of have this massive uprising. But also, if they came up to a constitutional crisis and things didn't go well, that they would revert to another convention and start the process of constitutional coups that they had seen in France. And so every moment of tension, whether it be worrying about a street mob or whether it be a contested election, that was what they were thinking about at the time and shaped their fears that their republic would fall apart at any moment.
Yeah, and there's, you know, you mentioned the Haitian Revolution too. I think we sometimes underestimate how big a political event that was, where you have, you know, the white dominant white class basically overthrown by a largely mulatto, but I mean, clearly a by and large a black kind of slave uprising. And it succeeds, and it's led by a charismatic leader, Toussaint Louverture. And, you know, that's also sending these kind of ripples, particularly through the South with its deep fear of slave revolts.
And it then, and it metastasizes in the U.S. in the 1800 election, as Lindsay points out in the book, with Gabriel's Rebellion right in the middle of the election.
Yeah, so these are fears that, you know, what's interesting is that the xenophobia about immigrants was bipartisan at the time, but for different reasons. Federalists worried that these French immigrants were going to come in and side with the Jeffersonians and were going to overthrow their government and have this French radical system. And the Jeffersonian Republicans were worried that Haitian immigrants would come in and start a slave uprising. And so they both kind of had these different fears. And as you said, Gabriel's Rebellion seemed to crystallize that response and made it much more difficult. It really ended any abolitionist discussion in Virginia. But I think actually, John, some of the response of the North, the New Englanders, and John Quincy Adams in particular, is telling, because they basically said, you know, these are the people who are most loudly in favor of French democracy. Let them have it.
You do a marvelous job of talking about how when after Washington dies suddenly, Adams is finally out from under the shadow, he moves relatively quickly to establish presidential supremacy again over the military. And he cashiers his Secretary of War, James McHenry. And then he moves on to do the same with his, and I have to say, as you know, 30-year Foreign Service officer, appalling Secretary of State, Timothy Pickering. Who completely attempts to at you know almost every turn try to subvert his president's foreign policy and undermine it. You know, this is to Eliot's point about the quasi war. John Adams is trying to use diplomacy. He's got Jay's Treaty behind him, you know, done in the Washington administration that you know has set the course of U.S. British relations. He wants to find something similar to do with the French so that there can be a kind of equipoise in American foreign policy, not because we're we're a rising empire, but we're still relatively weak compared to these big European powers. There's no point in getting into a dust up with them. And Pickering and Hamilton and the arch Federalists are busy trying to undermine him and basically, although they protest about it a lot, basically tie our plight to the British.
Yes, absolutely. So Adams did a couple of things. So the first thing he did was he very intentionally slow rolled the Navy, especially in contrast to, slow rolled the Army, especially in contrast to the Navy. And again, that sounds like something we wouldn't want the president to do, but this was really not the army that we would want in the United States. So he intentionally delayed any nominations, any officer appointments that he could. When he had to sign off on them, he went as slow as possible while doing the exact opposite with the Navy. And then at the same time, he pursued diplomacy, knowing that successful diplomacy would make it harder to keep these officer corps and the regiments and the army built up strong. And as soon as he was able to secure diplomacy, his wisdom was proven prescient because soldiers started deserting and officers returned to their commission. So he worked to use distance to his advantage to slow roll the army, built up the Navy as much as possible to strengthen his diplomatic position, pursued diplomacy and fought with his cabinet to get those appointments actually approved in the Senate, which was a hard-won thing. And then his final step was to remove the Secretary of State from the cabinet. And as you said, Timothy Pickering was a truly dreadful Secretary of State. It wasn't even just that he was at times downright insubordinate, which he was. He had the worst possible disposition for a Secretary of State because he viewed compromise as a moral failing. And he thought that anyone who disagreed with him needed to be destroyed. And he thought he was the smartest person in the room, despite having spent time with a lot of the greatest minds in American history. So he just, like, you could not find a person. He also had never left the country. He didn't have any diplomatic experience. He spoke poor French. So you could not find a person who was probably more poorly suited to this position.
Well, luckily, we don't have any people like that in power now. You know? I don't know. I don't think I've ever encountered anybody that bad. Sorry.
It really is. It's truly extraordinary. And, you know, I actually recorded the audiobook of this book, which was really fun. And when I was recording it, we stopped at a certain point and the audiobook engineer was like, but wait, I need to find out if he fires Pickering, because I had made him hate Pickering so much.
The only thing that surprises me is how long it took him to fire Pickering. I mean, yes. As you read your account of it, you know, as I was reading it, I was sitting there saying, fire this son of a bitch.
Yes. So I think it was two things. I think it was one, I think once Washington died, that gave him some space to move. I think he also was waiting to see if he got the Federalist renomination, which he did. Because then he moved pretty quickly after that. But he offered Pickering the opportunity to resign, because that was the gentleman's way out. And Washington had never fired anybody. Either people had retired on their own accord, or if they felt they had lost Washington's faith, then they resigned on their own without any sort of prompting. So he offered Pickering the opportunity to resign, and Pickering sent a remarkably snotty letter back saying, yeah, I don't think so. I think I'm going to stay in office. I don't know if he was calling Adams bluff. I don't know if he thought that the Senate would back him up, but Adams sent him a letter removing him, no salutations, no, thank you for your service, and change the locks on the Secretary of State offices so that Pickering could not take documents with him, which established a critical precedent that presidents can actually do that, because until that point, it was very much theoretical and untested.
Well, that actually, I think, raises a very interesting point. You know, the idea that you have an extremely powerful president who has control over their cabinet. And you make this point in the book, as opposed to the traditional idea of British cabinet government, which is not quite what you have now, which has moved a little bit more to a system that in some ways feels a little bit more like ours, where prime ministers really, really dominate. But the idea that you have a collective, that you don't have a collective executive, that was different. And I think it shows up in something that you document in a way that's really gobsmacking when you read it, is the extent to which cabinet secretaries felt it was okay to be completely disloyal to the president, as in, you know, corresponding all the time with Hamilton. You know, the president asks you a question, and instead of responding to him directly, you know, you check it out with Hamilton to see if Hamilton's cool with it. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, particularly given that, you know, the 18th century is an era in which individual honor as well as national honor matters, that this somehow doesn't violate the code. You know, backstabbing the president of the United States. And in that way, we're quite a long way from that in terms of what we think the norms are, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. You know, and it's interesting because if you compared how the secretaries operated or proclaimed that they operated under the Adams administration, about how they thought that power should be shared among the cabinet and when cabinet secretaries had the right to be disobedient or to obstruct presidential policy, they did none of those things with Washington. So clearly this was very much a personality conflict as opposed to a ideological interpretation of the executive. And yet it was how they chose to sort of inhabit those offices. And I think the striking thing for me was the lack of expectation on their parts of secrecy in conversations with the president and conversations in the cabinet. So Adams clearly had an expectation of privacy, but they did not share it and felt very free to tell people about those conversations, to share documents of those conversations. Towards the end of the presidency, when Alexander Hamilton had lost it and was going to write a pamphlet decrying John Adams and his election or re-election campaign, Oliver Wolcott Jr. sent him documents from the department to bolster these claims, which we would consider to be extraordinarily inappropriate today. And so that does show to a certain extent our expectation of norms and privacy and precedence about how these departments are supposed to operate has indeed evolved.
You know, what, one of the other things that I think important for our listeners and viewers to take on board is, and I had not appreciated this until I read your book, that, that Adams really has this cabinet dictated to him. This is not really his cabinet. This is really Washington's cabinet that, and this again goes to Eliot's earlier point about Washington not really treating Adams very well. He, instead of allowing him the latitude to select his own cabinet, he bequeaths Pickering, McHenry, several others to him kind of at the tail end of his presidency with the expectation that they will stay on. And as you point out, it's only when Washington dies that Adams really feels he's, you know, free to actually fire these guys who have been stabbing him, not in the back, they've been stabbing him in the front for like 3 years.
And that's even though Washington knows that they're second raters. I mean, that's the other thing, that if you look at, you know, the beginning of the Washington administration, it's all the greats. It's, you know, the good Hamilton at the Treasury. Jefferson, you know, you can give some credit to it, but by the end, those guys are gone, and these are not the best and brightest. And I, you have to think that Washington knew that. And yet, you know, he sticks Adams with it. And I am still baffled by the fact that he does not share anything with Adams. Now, of course, Roosevelt didn't share some of the most important stuff with Truman either. So maybe there's,
It is baffling because, you know, Adams wrote about this conversation that he had with Washington in the spring of 1796. So about 4 or 5 months before Washington published the farewell address, in which they finally had, 8 years into the presidency, a very substantive, deep conversation about foreign policy and the world generally. And they realized that they were completely on the same page about pretty much everything. So that should have been a starting point for much closer cooperation and communication about what was going to happen next. And instead, as you said, I don't blame Washington for Adams keeping the secretaries. Adams did so because he felt as though he kind of had to. There was no model of this changing. He really needed to provide institutional stability for people and continuity. He had never been in a cabinet meeting, so he didn't really know how they worked, and he figured that they would be loyal to him. What I do blame Washington for is exactly what you said, which was pointing out that some of these secretaries were not good, and Washington knew it. He knew that Pickering was dispositionally terribly suited for the State Department, and he knew that McHenry was not up to the demands of the job and had complained about it while he was president. And yet he encouraged them to stay on and did not give Adams a heads up. And I don't know if he did so because he didn't trust Adams and he thought the secretaries would provide continuity, or if he did so because he thought that he shouldn't interfere. I'm not sure what the reason was. I suspect it's more of the former, that he wanted the secretaries to continue his policies. But again, if he had talked to Adams, they were so closely aligned on foreign policy, they would have agreed on so much.
Of course, sometimes a very successful CEO doesn't particularly want their successor to do all that well. You know, I think that's, I think that's a human thing, particularly when, if it's somebody who's older. Can I shift it a little bit? So much I'd like to talk to you about in this book. The Essex Junto. So the idea that, you know, there's this really kind of cabal of arch Federalists. And of course, when you get to the War of 1812, people are saying, oh, the Hartford Convention, they're actually planning to secede.
Secessionists, yeah.
Yeah, they're you know, all in the pocket of Great Britain. How seriously should we take that? I mean, you're clearly sympathetic to Adams, and those people gave him a very rough time. But wait, how seriously? How bad were the real hardline Federalists?
They were pretty bad. I think where the blame with them lies is they had become so radicalized that they believed that any means were appropriate to crush the threat that they saw in the Jeffersonian Republicans and by extension France. So they were willing to throw out the First Amendment. They were willing to take away civil rights for basically all all recently arrived immigrants, even naturalized Americans in some cases, and they turned against the more moderate members of their own party with such ferocity that they ended up saving some of the most virulent rhetoric for those members.
Sounds very familiar.
I was going to say, I see a lot of parallels on this thing specifically to today. And so what I found to be amazing is people who had known Adams for decades, had commended his service for decades, started talking about him as an evil to be destroyed. That takes a remarkable amount of intellectual perversion to get to that point. And that's where I think they were really dangerous.
You know, as I read it on this point, it really struck me the degree to which both sides are willing to, as you walk through the steps that were going on in various, whether it was diplomacy with France or the consideration of the Alien and Sedition Acts or the trials or how the trials were held, everybody on both sides, the Republicans and the Federalists, are putting absolutely the worst possible construction on what the other folks are doing and seeing it as part of a looming catastrophe. I mean, it's all the Jacobins are going to take over and we're going to have a guillotine, you know, in Market Square in Philadelphia or, you know, outside the White House, you know, or it's the, you know, the aristocrats are going to impose a monarchy on us. You know, the, you know, John Adams sends John Quincy Adams, you know, off to Berlin as minister. And by all accounts, everybody thinks he's one of the most gifted diplomats of his generation. And
which history has borne out.
By the way, greatest Secretary of State in our history, just saying. But but they see that as this is, you know, this is the precursor of monarchy. Instead of, although I was interested and hadn't realized that Jefferson actually asked Abigail Adams during the transition whether maybe John Quincy might stay on, as, and of course he ends up being, you know, Monroe's Secretary of State. So, you know, it all has a happy ending, but, and it does seem so, redolent of our own time, of the kind of polarization we have now, the kind of catastrophic political rhetoric people have, you know, use on both sides, although it's not equal on both sides. Let me just stipulate that so we don't get angry comments on the show. I just wonder whether, you know, your takeaway from this. I mean, this clearly happened at the beginning of the Republic. It's now happening again. Is that something that's just in human nature, or is there something specific that brings that kind of thing, you know, out?
I think it's cyclical. I think there have been moments where we have been less inclined to use this rhetoric, where there have been a lot of, you know, intense debates, but they're over things like tax policy and education policy as opposed to the future of the Republic. And so I think in moments where it gets really bad, it's often because it does seem that there is a question of the Constitution going forward. And so in the 1790s, it's really interesting because they have this rhetoric and they use it at times when the stakes are not that high, when it'll be fine. If one of the other side wins a local election, it'll be fine. But in 1800, they do actually come remarkably close to throwing it all away. And I think there was a period of time when the House of Representatives starts the balloting for the election, because under the terms of the Constitution, once Jefferson and Burr have a tie, then the House of Representatives begins the balloting to figure out who's going to win. And between February 11th, when they started the voting, and March 4th, when the next president was going to be inaugurated, there were a series of debates about what should be done, who should be president. Had the Federalists been able to stall out that process to March 4th and put a temporary president in place, and the Republican militias marched in from Virginia and Pennsylvania, which they were ready to do, they were at the border, I genuinely don't know what would have happened. that is a moment where all of that very insane rhetoric is totally warranted. So I think that it's both that this is a cyclical part of American democracy where we genuinely do have moments of constitutional crisis, and that language tends to bubble up prior to those moments. And then if you're lucky, which they were at that time, you come up with a resolution and everyone kind of agreed without saying it to tamp it down, kind of tamp down some of those excesses. You realize how close you got to destroying it and you try and move forward. Hence Jefferson's, we are all Republicans, we are all Federalists.
Although you were terrific in pointing out that, and maybe you're a little, I think, maybe even too generous to Jefferson, because you say he flirts with violence. And then you recount his conversation with Adams about all this, where Adams is basically trying to tell him, I'm not going to stand in your way. I'm not going to get involved in these intrigues that Sedgwick and Hamilton and others are engaged in about what might, you know, getting Burr elected. And Jefferson basically threatens him with violence, that there'll be a revolution if I'm not elected.
But you know what's interesting, Eric, is that that's right. And Lizzie you really do a great job of describing that very tense encounter. That's on the one, and of course before that you had the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, which are essentially threatening secession. And yet, it's also Jefferson who kind of brings the country together after 1800 with that famous speech that you just quoted. So in a way, that's a story about the complexity of, you know, some of the characters that we get in politics. And I think this is the encouraging part, that you can go through these terrible moments of constitutional crisis, you know, and then things kind of calm down more or less. And I think there may be that, you know, in that respect, there may be a lesson for our times too. I wanted to ask, we're running short of time, which is really unfortunate. I wanted to ask one last question from me. And that's about the personality of John Adams. One of the things that's lovely about the book, you show not just the fact that there was this sort of deep, loving relationship between John and Abigail, but really how Abigail is quite important to in many ways in terms of being a sounding board and, I mean, all many different roles. But I thought one of the most interesting things is the way Adams tended to get portrayed, and that may be the television series may have reinforced this a bit unintentionally, is he's a temperamental guy, he's got a short fuse, and all of which is true. But I think the point that you make, which is really worth thinking about, is this is also the guy who knows how to write a ferociously angry letter and then put it in a drawer and either not send it or send a much cooler version the next day. So it's a guy, he's portrayed as a guy who understands himself, I think much better than we sometimes think. And I don't know if you want to say anything to that, but I thought that was one of the most interesting parts of the book.
I do. I would love to say something about that. So the thing that I like best about John Adams, and the thing that drives me the most crazy about Thomas Jefferson, is that John Adams was acutely aware of his flaws, and he did not deny them, and he worked hard to overcome them and recognize when he did not. And he could be self-deprecating about that and have a sense of humor. And I find that self-honesty to be so delightfully refreshing. In terms of how we think about him and the image that we have, one of the things that blew my mind when I was reading all of these books by phenomenal historians who I have so much respect for and whose work I've enjoyed so much, is if I looked at the descriptions of him, and then I looked at the descriptions written of Adams by Jefferson and Hamilton, often in the moment when they are fighting political battles against him and are essentially writing political propaganda against Adams, oftentimes historians will take those descriptions verbatim. And on no other issue do they take Hamilton or Jefferson at their word. And no other issue are they willing to like be uncritical of that assessment. And yet on John Adams, they are. And so I think the combination of Hamilton and Jefferson and the combination of the Federalist Party eventually collapsing and Hamilton really being the heir apparent of the Federalist Party and sort of Adams being without a party meant that his legacy was written by people who didn't like him. And that's really unfortunate.
We are running out of time, but I do want to close with one question for you, Lindsay. In some ways, this book, you know, can be seen as a description of the early death throes of the Federalist Party. It's, you know, riven by faction, destroys the presidency of, it's really, Washington was in some sense above party, really, although he clearly is a party figure as well. But Adams is the first real, you know, Federalist president in the sense of a political party that's not just a kind of emerging faction. He, as you say, he ends up being a president without a party. Kind of the party lives on after, you know, Jefferson's election, but it's never a real national force again. It becomes a regional force, and then it almost extinguishes itself during the War of 1812, or it does extinguish itself, really. You've written in the Bulwark about the death of political parties. You talked about the Federalists. You also talked about the Whigs breaking up. You know, about a year ago, or no, less than a year ago, I guess around January, we had Liz Cheney on the show talking about her book. And we, Elliot and I, were asking her whether, you know, is the Republican Party after Trump salvageable, you know, or is it, you know, fated to go into some kind of paroxysm like the Federalists and the Whigs? I recognize we're getting out of the lane of history here, but I'm just, you know, your historically informed answer, I think, would be, you know, fascinating to hear.
Well, yeah, I wrote that piece with Sarah Longwell because I was seeing the Republican Party of today do an awful lot of what the Federalist Party was doing back then, which is that it had become institutionally quite weak. It is dominated by its most radical voices. It is pushing out the moderate voices, not giving them space, not protecting difference of opinion, not protecting incumbents from primaries, all of the things that generally lead to party destruction over time. And so I could see two different ways where that could go, where it could become kind of the increasing rump faction like the Federalists and then sort of disappear, or factions of it like the Whig Party could split off and eventually form another party. I don't think we're going to probably ever have an era of good feelings again. We're not going to have a one party state, but I do think that there could be another thing that bubbles up potentially to take its place. But at the current moment, given that it is increasingly more and more radical and it is speaking to fewer and fewer voters and it is targeting fewer and fewer voters, that is just not a long-term electoral strategy, and history bears that out. Now, which direction it will go, I'm not sure, but on its current trajectory, that's just not a long-term sustainable party plan. And so I think there are a couple of ways that it could crumble and rebuild, but I think that that is likely to happen.
Well, I think that will have to be it for this episode of Shield of the Republic. Our guest has been Lindsay Chervinsky, the author of Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. I hope all of you will go out and buy it and read it. You will be the wiser for it. Lindsay, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait, and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to TraceMinerals.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace.